Hello, this is Tamiko Faison, your host for Therapy Entrepreneurs and Leaders of Color, a podcast dedicated to therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color around the world who are leading in their space. It is about sharing their stories and supporting them in their roles. Our guest today is Victoria Garcia Wilburn, DHSC. You're going to have to tell me what that stands for.
Absolutely.
OTR and CLT, you'll have to tell me that one as well, is an assistant professor of occupational therapy in the School of Health and Human Sciences at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Dr. Victoria Garcia Wilburn is a community-engaged scholar, practitioner, researching outcomes and implementing community-based programs, both at the community and population level, that impact practitioners and consumers of occupational therapy services and delivery of occupational therapy services with an emphasis on underserved practice and settings. She is speaking my language here. Our most current projects focus on investigating the outcomes from implementing occupation-based programming for adolescents in substance use disorder recovery. She is an awardee of the Robert Wood Johnson New Connections Award, the Latino Leadership Circle from the Indiana Latino Institute, 2018 Occupational Therapist of the Year, all right now, from the Indiana Occupational Therapy Association, and a recent fellow from the American Occupational Therapy Association. Wow, congratulations. She is current chairperson for the Affiliate State Associations of Presidents for AOTA and is a candidate for a 2021 Board of Directors position. Elections are right now. Voting, you're available. You can vote right now. So we are so thankful and grateful to have you here, Victoria. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be with you today.
So when did you get the fellow recognition? That's really
First, I want to explain my credentials to you.
Okay, yeah, great. Yeah, let's go back to that.
So I have a Doctor of Health Science, And I am also a certified lymphedema therapist. So that's where the CLT comes in. And interesting fact, in Indiana, we don't use the L. So I am a licensed occupational therapist, but the licensing board says it's redundant to use the L. So that's why you see OTR. There's some confusion around that too. So, you know, alphabet soup, here we are. But yes, thank you for the congratulatory regarding the fellow. That just happened this year. And I feel very, very honored with that commendation. And so I would love for it to serve as an example that many like myself in the Latinx community, there's more to come. So I'm just excited to be able to show others the way in which we can continue to be trailblazers and be a part of solutions for our association.
Thank you so much. It is very inspiring. I did a post a while back where I said, you know, when you see someone achieve something that has not been achieved before, it is inspiring. So really appreciate you being a trailblazer in your space. And now I want you to tell us about yourself in your own words. I learned a little bit about you when I heard you speak the other day at the town hall that AOTA had, and was very impressed with your responses to the questions. And I want to talk a little bit about that as we move further into the conversation. But if we can start by you just telling us all about who Victoria is and how you became interested in occupational therapy.
Sure. It's, you know, I've said this story a few times now, so I'll give you a little bit of a different spin, because I think in life we discredit some of the lenses in which we experience things. So I came to occupational therapy first as a physical therapy major, right? I was unaware completely of the OT profession. But I think there's so much to be said about that. Right. So as we're grappling our heads with how do we make this profession more diverse, I think the first question we need to ask ourselves is, how do we allow other Black and Brown individuals to feel as if they belong in our profession? So I knew nothing about occupational therapy and certainly did not know any other Latinx providers within my space. And so I was the only Latinx individual in my program. So switched majors after taking a course about, you know, the introduction to healthcare professions, and was the last cohort of the bachelor's program of OT at Boston University. And so I didn't realize at the time what a risk that was to change majors. And I certainly was unaware of the prestigiousness of Boston University's OT program. So, you know, I definitely believe that things happen for a reason. And so I learned from some of the best and brightest academics, practitioners, scientists in the field, you know, at the time and to this day. And so I don't take that lightly. I think a piece of my Boston University upbringing goes with me wherever I am. I was privileged enough to learn from Dr. Elsie Vergara, who is a Puerto Rican researcher and scientist doing very innovative things in the NICU. And so she was a mentor to me in my career because she knew much of my lived experience. The daughter of two migrant workers, right, that traveled the United States picking the food in which we place on our dinner table as children. And they decided that they wanted something different as they married and started having children. And so education was instilled very early on in my upbringing. Even though my mom only had an eighth grade education, my dad, you know, high school diploma, they wanted something different for us. And so that was, you know, unique growing up in that space too. So occupational therapy is certainly part of my story. And I just want to share that knowledge and love and what we bring as a profession to the table with others, especially from my background and others.
Yeah, you bring up a good point about differences with the background, because a lot of times we talk about ethnicity, but socioeconomic status and first generation, I don't know if it's talked about as much. And I'm curious to know, how did you feel confident in terms of becoming a leader with the background of, you know, being a first generation college students? I'm also a first generation college graduate. I was raised by my grandma and my mom, and my grandma had a fifth grade education. And I've had conversations with some other OTs who also first generation, and we've had conversations about imposter syndrome, and some people think it exists and some people say no, it doesn't. different conversations about that. But certainly for me, it was sometimes very difficult to feel like I was on the same level as others based on previous experiences or should I say lack of experiences and exposure. So did that impact you at all?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. And I think, you know, in all transparency, those are some of the things I still grapple with today. Right. And, now having children myself, I realize that, I need to grow from that space because I have a mentor. She's the dean of she's the associate dean of faculty at our school. And she reminds me that, you know, nobody gave you these things, right? Nobody gave you your degrees. Nobody said, hey, would you like to, you know, be in this space? Nobody invited you. You earned that. And, when there's people, when you don't have immediate people in your life, like your parents or, you know, other caregivers that have showed you that can be done and that is possible, it's a bit harder to navigate what we can't see. Mm-hmm. It's almost like we're walking in the dark. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this new year, I've really committed to myself to change the narrative of my story, right? That I am resilient, that I have earned these things, that there does come great responsibility with the places that I sit in. And that's what I think I'd like to hold on to and focus, but agree, you know, certainly imposter syndrome is real. And that's internal fear that those of us that come from backgrounds not of privilege, that may be unique to our story, but we can certainly use that and garner some more resilience. Because certainly I want my two daughters, right? Their father, my partner is a Black man. So I'm raising, you know, Afro-Latinas, and I want them to know that it is possible, right? So my husband's back at school, non-traditional law student, you know, in his mid-40s. So that we can create these paths together. And by us doing and stepping into spaces that are unfamiliar, it's empowering. So I want other practitioners, not just in OT, but in every healthcare discipline, to recognize that there's solidarity in our upward mobility. Well, that's certainly what I can promise for sure. Maybe others don't feel that way, but I believe that, right? When we rise together.
Yeah, I remember you said that in the message, when we rise together, because you're right. We can contribute to the entire profession. It's not just about one single person. It's about everyone and legacies and making a path for others. And you said empowering. It's about empowering. And I was thinking about the word imposter that we talked about before, and then contrasting it with empowering. What if we change the narrative, as you said, from imposter syndrome to empowering syndrome? Because when we really you know, all that it takes to overcome barriers and to share those stories with others, and then to be mentors for others, it is empowering. And again, not just for who we're mentoring, but for the entire profession, the populations that we serve, the communities that we serve that are waiting on us to step out outside of a fear and show how we've been able to overcome barriers. This is what we encourage the people we serve to do, to overcome barriers. And, you know, we can be examples of that. So I love that you said, let's change the narrative. And it does require work. And I'm on the same page with you, Victoria, in terms of, you know, many years and many accomplishments, so to speak, on paper, but still use mentors and coaches to help me with mindset based on some of that history. So you said in this last response, I can promise you what I'm going to work on. So let's transition into your leadership roles. If you can talk some about your previous leadership roles, your current leadership roles, and this position you're running for with AOTA.
I think, you know, personal context, right? I'm the youngest of five, and we're all girls. Okay. So I was destined to be a leader because no one would pay attention to me otherwise, right?
Yeah.
And my sisters will tell you that. And there's a bit of an age difference between me and my my youngest oldest sister. So there's about a 10-year span between us. So I was really able and fortunate to see them kind of grow up and then think about, how can I do that better or different? And so that, you know, for that, for sure, I thank them. So I have never gone about things in a traditional way, right? So when I moved to Indiana, I was not as involved with the state level association as I should have been. But then when I became a member, I thought to myself, I would love an opportunity not just to sit at the table, but to lead in Indiana. So I took a huge, we talked about risk before, took a huge risk. And, you know, I was a relatively unknown name in my state. You know, I didn't have at the time, I didn't have my doctorate. I was just finishing my doctorate. And So I wasn't associated with a university, or I wasn't with a longstanding institution or any of those things that kind of sort of give you some extra visibility than others. And which is silly, because practitioners really are phenomenal state leaders. And so I was a practitioner going to school and took a chance. And to my, surprise, I won the election. And I think it was because I was authentically me, and I can't be anything else but. So having that opportunity to lead, harnessing my knowledge in change leadership, really, I think, took us as a state to different spaces and different levels. I mean, not everything was a victory. We're still pursuing some critical changes we'd like to see in Indiana, including increasing the equity of occupational therapists being recognized as behavioral and mental health providers in our state. And that, led itself to this opportunity to be the chairperson for all 50 states. And the best test, I would say, of my leadership has been helping to lead throughout all of the changes that have occurred this year. And I could not be more proud of the response of all of the state associations during COVID, during social unrest, changing paradigms and thinking more intently about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging that they, had not addressed before. Speaking about trailblazers, they're trailblazers in their own right. And so when this election cycle opened up, I felt a deep responsibility to run for a board of directors position because there's a uniqueness that I bring to the table that cannot be carbon copied. I'm almost sure that nobody else has a story like me. But I believe that there are several people in our professions that have a story just like mine. So if I can help to inspire and create change for members, with the membership being at the front facing of our association, then I know I will have at least accomplished something. So that, yeah. I hope that answers your question. I don't know.
It does. This position as a chairperson for affiliate state associations, and it's really interesting how you sound like you just embrace change, and that's to me is like a sign of a true leader, because change is not always comfortable, particularly the changes that we've dealt with in our country, or I would say even around the world, the changes that we've been dealing with, and the conversations, can be very uncomfortable, but it's, just listening to your voice when you were speaking, it sounded like you embraced it and you're like welcoming it. But this role as an affiliate state, what do you do in this role? How do you work with the presidents of the state associations?
Right. So I have an amazing support staff of liaisons from AOTA. Chuck Wilmarth, Megan Pertler, Kristen Neville, just to name a few that are really pivotal in advancing state initiatives. So what I do really is lend my expertise as far as state presidents' needs and addressing and orchestrating initiatives that are for the betterment of all 50 states. So a lot, I would say since my tenure as chairperson, we have offered more educational webinars and town hall initiatives, more tangible and concrete ways for resource sharing, utilizing Communot as a bit of a repository so that states aren't having to redevelop or rethink the wheel. Inspiring state leaders to continue to make bold decisions and changes. And so I'm just, you know, I look at myself more as a facilitator, quite honestly, than as, you know, a top down approach where I'm giving a charge and people are following orders. That's not how it works. It's really collaborative leadership, and it's a great position. I think it's not well known, and that's unfortunate because so much happens at the state level. So, I mean, our ability to practice, you know, that happens at the state level. So when all of those changes were happening with telehealth and advocacy, that was the hard work of state associations. And we need to remember that in conjunction, obviously, with national initiatives. But so many of those implementations were done effectively and timely. So that's really what my role consists of, is being a grand facilitator.
Yeah, you are teaching me, because I did not know this position exists either. And I do shout out to North Carolina OT Association. They were on top of it. And I'm sure we're collaborating with you in the process in terms of the changes related to telehealth and reimbursement and all that. Everything happened so fast. And so I was really appreciative of the associations, the state and the national, in terms of how they were keeping us informed and advocating. But speaking of things that may not be well known, I'm going to kind of circle back to your bio when we talked about implementing occupation-based programming for adolescents in substance use disorder recovery, and what you said about your efforts to advocate for OTs to be recognized in the behavioral health system. This is an area that's very near and dear to my heart as well, because, as you know, where OT has its roots, and there's been a shift, and I think we're trying to become more recognized in behavioral health, and we've lost that in some places. What successes have you had in that area, and can you talk a little bit about what you're doing leadership-wise?
It's been a journey, I will tell you. You know, I think a huge win has been SAMHSA's recognition of occupational therapists as behavioral health providers, as evidenced by our inclusion in the expanding of certified community behavioral health centers, right? So that's a win. But getting that implemented and on the ground and running at state levels is challenging. You know, I'm not going to beat around the bush about it. That's challenging. And in order for that to happen, there needs to be evidence, right? And so a large part of my career has been helping to establish foundational evidence to support occupational therapy's roles in these community-based settings. So my colleague and I, Dr. Wasmuth and Dr. Chase and a practitioner, Dr. Ham, who's a clinical psychologist, just published an article in OT and Mental Health regarding our findings of a narrative-informed occupation-based treatment approach at the community level compared to treatment as usual. And that was innovative. I have just recently finished a study in conjunction with Indianapolis's Recovery High School, looking at how occupational therapy group programming promotes connectedness among a sample size. So it's preliminary evidence that supports the big picture, right? We know that we are in a huge deficit of mental and behavioral health providers. We know that we're at even greater deficit of mental and behavioral health providers in non-majority communities. Mm-hmm. So how can we harness and increase the workforce, utilize occupational therapists? So I'm really excited. I know I have a publication coming soon in AJOT giving a template for other states of how to go about this, using Indiana as a case exemplar. So we are in continued discussions with our Medicaid office about including occupational therapists as a Medicaid rehab option for consumers in Indiana. There's, you know, all of these barriers have a reason why. So for us in particular in Indiana, it's some language that was written a very long time ago that states that occupational therapists cannot provide psychiatric services. And that's confusing, right? That's confusing to program development. That's confusing to consumers. It's confusing to providers. Nobody else provides psychiatric services but psychiatrists, right? What we do is provide interventions that are occupation-based to assist with psychosocial elements, right, that impact function. And we have to look at all of these intersections of policy and research and mobilization in order to create that change. So I hope that article is of value to others looking to create the same change in their states. But that's why I think my degree has served me, because the doctorate of health science really, you know, it takes solid research for change, right? For translational science change. And so it's been a learning process, and it's something I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, I owe you a big thank you, because I don't know if you know that we have an OT in North Carolina. I think the only OT in North Carolina working at a CCBHC. And it was because the language in the describing, you know, the professionals includes OT. And so I have to thank you for your efforts in ensuring that we had a seat at the table. So I'm very interested in this article. If you can share that, if we're able to put it in the podcast bio, that information needs to be, and it needs to be shared, because I think a lot of OTs around the country want to work in mental health. They just don't know how to do it. And so for leaders who are in place at the and helping at the policy level, which is amazing that you are showing the evidence, you know, providing evidence. We know that OT brings value, but if we don't have evidence and data, people working at the policy level, we're not going to have a seat at the table. So again, thank you. Thank you for all that you've been doing in that space.
Absolutely. It's in press. So when that gets out, I will be sure to share it with you. Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Now, in terms of the percentage of OTs of color in our profession, we're at a low percentage. And I think Dr. Arame mentioned it, that we went backwards for African-Americans. I think she said there was a small increase for Latinx and Hispanic practitioners. But we've got a ways to go. And I think we're taking steps in the right direction. But again, we have a ways to go. How has that impacted your roles? And what challenges have you had to overcome because of the lack of diversity?
It is dangerously risky for us not to be diverse. You know, when you don't have a practitioner that comes from the same ethnic, racial, gender, background as you do, you lose some advocacy. Just two quick examples, right? Right here in Indiana. So we lost a Black woman during childbirth in Indiana. She was a chief resident at our pediatric hospital. It's astounding to me how the mortality rate for women of color in Indiana is so high, right? So there's real repercussions when we're not represented. And she was knowledgeable, right? She was leading others of her team. And it's just, you know, it's a tragedy. And these stories need to stop. These stories, there needs to be an end to this story that we have. So I want to help in writing that final chapter, right? And the only way that I can do that is being in a position of influence. So sharing what that's like to grow up the only brown girl, right, in the classroom, or the only brown girl that experiences X, Y, and Z symptoms. What can those be? You know, what can that come from? How can I advocate for myself? Helping to decrease these medical errors because of bias. You know, so we have to have a more diverse workforce across all spectrums of healthcare. And that only happens when there's a diversity in leadership. So I agree. AOTA is taking some intentional steps to move past the cycling of our history of being, you know, invested in multiculturalism and diversity, and then not be, and then me being invested, and then not having any money behind the initiatives, and then being invested, you know. So we need to stop that cycling. And I think we're on a good path to that. And then I think we need to write a new chapter. So there's just so much, there's so many dangerous implications when we're not diverse. And that's my commitment to membership, is that I said this in the town hall, if policies and structures and systems aren't equitable, then I can't give my stamp of approval on it. It has an equality and belonging, diversity, that has to be the fabric of who we are, not as an additional thought. So that's my commitment as I serve the membership. I hope that answered your question. I get so passionate about these things and I'm like, what was the original question? But you know, girl, it's how it is sometimes. I have to be true to who I am. Yeah, because everything else is disingenuous.
Yeah, I can definitely hear the passion in your voice, and you are answering the questions. And I'm enjoying hearing your responses and the passion. It is definitely genuine. You know, including belonging. You know, we say DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think you said in the town hall, there's a word that we're missing, belonging, because we can have diversity. You know, we can have people with differences. We can have equity where we're being fair, and we can have inclusion. So you're invited to the party, but do you feel like you belong to the party? And you said earlier, you have to have diversity in leadership in order to set the stage for what we're seeking. And just thinking about, I kind of think while I'm talking, so if you hear me pause it, thinking about other people who are coming behind you, other students, other practitioners, when they're in the spaces and there's not the leadership, what advice do you give to them to share or to step up and become leaders? Because it can be so uncomfortable to share these stories like you just mentioned. And what is it like being the only brown girl in this particular setting, or something that you had to deal with, or even as a first generation, like when there's not someone who has experienced it. I actually had a conversation with someone a couple of days ago, and he said, you know, I want to share, but I don't know how it's going to be received. And so I don't share. And I could totally relate to that. What advice would you have for, because we don't have the diversity in leadership as we would like right now. So for those who are listening, who aren't in leadership roles and they have these experiences that can contribute, but it is very uncomfortable and they're concerned about how it may be received, because it's not always received. I would like to say it's received positively all the time, but there's definitely things that I've shared where people, they just don't know how to respond to it. So they say something out of ignorance, or they just stare at you like, you know, you're an alien. Where you can read the nonverbal communication and it's not positive. What advice do you have for those types of situations?
That's a great question. That is a great question. I can only answer from my experience and hope that it's of value. So there's my mantra for 2020 was share the mic. So we can't just be satisfied, like you said, right, with having that seat at the table. because if I've earned that seat at the table, then there's also going to be a sea of individuals that I'm going to bring to that table with me, right? In spirit, mm-hmm. because you have to extend. This isn't just my lived experience. It's also the lived experience of this person. And here's how, and that person, and this person, there is solidarity in that. And so it's not just about Victoria's voice, you know, being heard. It's about who Victoria represents. And so I think that, you know, I'm going to share the mic. I'm going to pass the mic to my student, you know, who's the only Black male in the program. I'm going to share the mic to, you know, my DACA students. I'm going to share the mic because that's what leadership is. And I think we have confused leadership along the way, you know, and I'm speaking in the vernacular, not just in AOTA, certainly. But we can all do so much better by sharing the mic, because then when you realize that it's not just my story, there's threads of my story and her story and his experience and her experience too. Then you're saying, aha, this is an issue. This is a problem, and we can't deny this anymore. We need to change this policy. We need to change this structure. We need to change the optics. So, again, you know, the only experience I can speak from is my own, but again, I can bet on that because I mentor quite a few first gen students, that there are threads of my story and theirs too. And so, yes, I think that's the best way. That's the best way to normalize diversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you said share the mic. So share the mic. And then you hear that you're not the only one, because sometimes mm-hmm. you think that, right? You think like, oh my goodness, nobody's going to understand this because I'm the only one. Right. But if we're sharing, then someone else might be more willing to share because they heard you share. So you share this mic and this can lead to change. And then maybe you can drop the mic, right?
That's right. And then, because 2021 is Together We Rise, then we're all going to benefit from it, right? So, you know, I just encourage everybody, pick a word, pick a phrase, you know, in a new year and set an intention on that. It's powerful. It's powerful. Like you talked about mindset. I mean, mindset is everything, you know, and we have to tap into that, that empowerment, with that lies within all of us.
So true. So true. So I was going to say, what's next for you, but what's now for you is this election, right? Right. But are there other, and vote. If you're listening and you have not voted, please vote. The link will be in the bio. The link is in Dr. Arame's bio from the last interview. If you are a member of AOTA and you are eligible to vote, please vote. But in addition to, there might not be anything else right now because that is a lot and you are committed to a lot of other leadership roles. But is there anything else you want to share about what you foresee professionally for yourself?
Well, what's next is now. I love that. You know, what's next is now. What's next now? And so I want to do a good job with what I've been given. Mm-hmm. And if I do that, what's next will unfold. And that's, you know, I have to live my life that way, because I get overwhelmed if I live it any other way. So I mentioned to you my mentor, the associate dean, you know, she said, I no longer write goals, right? Because if I do a good job with what I've been given today, that what's next is going to come. Mm-hmm. And so I've really embraced that. I've embraced that. And so I have enough for today. Yeah. Right? I have enough for today. And we will see what tomorrow will bring if I'm given that chance. And, you know, I know that what's next will come when the timing's ready, when the timing's right.
That's a great perspective. It's something that I'm definitely working on, because I think we are in a world where, and I am very goal oriented, but I've taken a step back and looked at, you know, just that, what you just said, what next is now, what is next is now. And the power of now is a book that I've been reading. My husband is a counselor and he's really into being present. He's like super laid back. But sometimes we can lose focus of all what is now because we're so far, like we're looking so far ahead. Mm-hmm. The power of right now and being present and what's going on right now. And I agree with you in that if we take care of what we have right now and are good stewards over all what is afforded to us, we always have a next.
That's right. That's right. I didn't know there was a book. So you added to my reading list. So for what's next for me is reading that book.
You have to let me know how you like it. It's been really powerful for me as well as some other people I know who've read it. Now, how can we support you? You mentioned, we have mentioned several times to vote, but are there other things that we could do to support you in your roles?
Oh, that is such a gracious question. Oh, man. You know, how I think you could support me is by doing the very best that what's been given to you. Because together we rise, my friend. Together we rise. So that's what I would like to speak into the universe.
Awesome. Is there anything else you would like us to know or any quote you would like to leave the audience with? You've already dropped a few of them. We've got a few new catchy phrases that we can use, right? The next is now. What we say, share the mic, drop the mic. And there was one other that you said earlier in the beginning. And I think you just said it a few minutes ago. I was trying to take notes, but I think I lost the last one. But you can always go back and rewind if you get to this part of the show to hear all of her great nuggets. But is there one last quote or nugget that you'd like to leave, words of wisdom with the audience?
Oh, I mean, I guess I have these isms, right? These Victoria-isms that are in my head. I should probably write a little ism book. Mike, I say this to my kids all the time, and this is no like Victoria quote at all. We've all read this and seen this before, but there is only one of you in the universe. And so I just think, you know, be beautifully who you were created to be, whatever that looks like, and allow those spaces to embrace you. Because I think where you receive rejection, you were never meant to be anyways. So that's what I want to leave us with. And you have been a joy. I wish we were connected like sooner, but I'm grateful to be connected now.
I am grateful as well. And again, thank you so much for sharing with us. Thank you for leading in DEI spaces. Thank you for leading with AOTA. Thank you for the work that you're doing in mental health. I definitely want to connect some more with you about those efforts. And I'm looking forward to the article that's in press. This has been very informative and a joy as well. And I just want to thank everybody for listening. Don't forget to follow us on Podbean. Until next time.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.